Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the past few months, we have been bombarded with stories about the backed up supply chain and how difficult it will be to get your holiday gifts in time. But very few of these stories mention consumption and its impact on our planet and our health. People in the United States are shopping more than ever. During the pandemic, people have been buying more and more online. Amazon recently announced that the company will become the largest U.S. package delivery service by early next year, surpassing UPS and FedEx. Since the pandemic began, Amazon has opened 450 new facilities, and since the end of 2019, hired 670,000 people, doubled its shipping container capacity, and ordered its own fleet of aircraft that will soon number 85. This is according to The Motley Fool. It's important to note that Amazon warehouses are being built in predominantly Black and Latino communities, exposing them to higher rates of air pollution. Last year, Amazon delivered over 4 billion packages just in the United States. 4 billion, according to Statista. This year, FedEx increased its daily deliveries to over 6.6 million packages. That is a lot of stuff. It's a lot of packaging, cardboard, bubble wrap, tape, and carbon emissions. U.S. shoppers are expected to spend up to $859 billion between last month and this month, according to the National Retail Federation. They expect a whopping $4.4 trillion to be spent this year. So again, what happened to the conversation about consumption? Joining us to talk about this issue are two guests. Anastasia O'Rourke is the managing director at the Carbon Containment Lab at Yale University. Anastasia has two decades of experience in the environmental sustainability field and has worked with federal and state governments, companies, NGOs, and more. Hi, Anastasia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk with you. JB McKinnon is an award-winning journalist and adjunct professor of journalism at the University of British Columbia, where he teaches feature writing. JB McKinnon is the author and co-author of 5 books. His latest is called The Day the World Stops Shopping: How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. And he writes, "The average American alone consumes so much that if everybody in the world lived the way they do, it would take 5 Earths to maintain such a global standard of living." Hi, JB. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. So, JB, you've written about this. Why aren't we talking more about consumption with all of these really crazy numbers about how much people are shopping in the U.S.?
Well, it's a really good question. It's been about 20 or 25 years since the last time that overconsumption itself was really at the heart of our conversations about sustainability or the environmental crises worldwide. I think part of the reason for that is that over the last 20 years, we've really made a turn towards this idea of green consumerism, or this idea that we can use things like renewable energy and energy efficiency, organic products, biodegradables, recyclable. We can use all of these things to kind of wave away the impacts of this scale of consumption.
What would you add, Anastasia? I mean, we've been waiting for the pieces about the supply chain to mention consumption, but it's very rare.
I think people are just starting to appreciate the supply chain kind of issues because there's been this big shock recently where, you know, you go try to buy something and it's actually not available. It's quite, you know, unusual. But of course, anyone who's been looking at environmental issues, especially in around consumption for a long time, we've known about the full sort of life cycle impacts of products and how this huge system that we've been building together as a human race has massive environmental impacts. So I think it shouldn't be a surprise, but it can be quite hard to imagine from your own sort of individual household point of view, just to the extent of it. So I think it's a bit of a, you know, wake-up call for everyone, or at least I hope it is. And I just also wanted to say that, you know, this is not just a US problem. I'm living in the US. I'm Australian, as you can hear, and we have a similar kind of consumption patterns in other countries as well. So people are definitely, it's a global issue.
Right. Can you both talk about how we got to this place? I mean, when you look at, and we can dive into this more deeply later in the show, but we get so much of our stuff now overseas. The prices that especially women make are still, I mean, the salaries that especially women make are so incredibly low. We've done so many shows about people in China, Vietnam, Bangladesh. The goods are cheaper. The technology has improved. The internet, of course, makes it too easy to find the cheapest price. So, JB, what really strikes you about what has changed over the past couple of decades? What explains how we got to this point?
I think we've been on a long journey to this point, beginning even with in the early 1900s with things like the development of planned obsolescence, which is this idea that things are designed not to last. And way back then, that wasn't as big a concern in terms of the environment as it is today. People weren't really thinking about this idea of a finite number of resources on the planet. They just thought, you know, if everybody's buying things that last, then what are all these businesses going to do? They can't sell and resell and resell the same product. Clearly, we really embraced that and have been moving in that direction more and more aggressively. And I think in the last couple of decades, what we've seen is just this wholesale shift to global production, which has allowed companies to drive down costs, wages, production costs, even the costs of materials to some extent. And that's allowed them to deliver cheap and increasingly disposable goods that we have to buy in higher volumes.
Anastasia, what would you add when you think about how we got to this point?
Well, I think the durability of products and services is a really interesting thing to think about because in some respects, you know, the problem is that, you know, we have these big stockpiles of waste and trash building up now. And that's in part because the products are durable beyond the use, you know, the period of time that we're using them for. And so if we can think of more creative design approaches where we're really designing things with the actual materials to, say, decompose in, you know, and so on, I think that we can solve this problem. But it's just this mismatch of timing of how long things are really functional for versus the materials, which are often, you know, around for decades, hundreds of years, thousands of years. And that's, you know, that's a huge problem. I really get distressed by things that break very easily myself and wish that things could be more repairable and that we could take care of it. But I'm not sure that everyone feels the same way. And I also, you know, do think that, okay, we can call it overconsumption, but the fact that goods and services are a lot cheaper has really helped a lot of people have a great quality of life. So let's not forget sort of why people are buying things and what they want to see, you know, out of that. And there's been some real social benefits from this whole system as well.
Well, right. That's an important point because during COVID, especially for elders, you know, people with pre-existing conditions, I mean, they really needed to shop online. They did not feel comfortable going into stores. That said, these numbers, JB, it's hard to wrap your head around this. I read this in the intro, but according to Statista, last year, Amazon delivered over 4 billion packages in the United States. It's hard to even imagine how they did that, but we see the Amazon trucks on a regular basis. FedEx is delivering daily over 6.6 million packages. And putting the show together, I thought about Costco. So I just did a quick search, and according to W Insight Grocery Business, Costco is just logging more openings. It posted its biggest year ever sales revenue last year, $163 billion in sales. What are your thoughts about these numbers? I mean, how can this continue?
I mean, clearly, I don't think that it can continue into the distant future. The numbers to me are shocking, and I think they do speak to a problem that I think we can fairly label overconsumption, at least for many of the consumers. So I look at something specific like the fact that holiday spending per capita in the United States has increased by 20% over the last 10 years. And I ask myself whether the holidays have become 20% more meaningful? Have they become 20% more fun? Are we actually getting, for many wealthy consumers around the world, are we really adding to quality of life, or are we just adding on consumption and all of its environmental and social consequences?
What does the research say about all of that? What does all of this shopping do to our mental health?
Well, I think, I mean, I spoke for my book to psychologists who study the value set that we refer to as materialism, or this set of values that are focused on income, possessions, and social status. And this is the value set that drives, it's right at the heart of consumer culture. And what they find is that, materialism is not, it's not useful for the development of life satisfaction. What we have instead, I suppose, is a chain of consumer experiences or consumer acquisitions that give us these temporary feelings of positivity or excitement. And if you stack enough of those up, then you have what I call in the book a reasonable facsimile of happiness. But, I don't think that it is. I don't think that it is contributing a lot in terms of a depth of meaning to our lives, or a deeper sense of well-being. And there's a considerable amount of evidence at this point that bears that up.
Well, and when you think about it, Anastasia, before we had online shopping, a lot of people who were stressed out or just kind of needed an escape would watch the online TV shows late at night and buy a lot of stuff. And now they can do that online with a short click. A family member who does have Amazon Prime recently told me that they recently said, if you buy something from Whole Foods, we'll deliver it to you in less than 2 hours. So what would you say about what this is doing to our overall well-being and our mental health?
I only have anecdotal evidence on this one. I think it is of concern. I do think we're all spending a lot of time shopping or browsing online that perhaps before we wouldn't have spent so much time browsing in stores. I don't know. But it is this sort of continuous, and along with social media, kind of continuous screen time that we're all experiencing, and sort of spending a lot of our creative energy towards. So it is a bit of a concern. I think a lot of people are beyond the environmental impact, certainly the social sort of problems associated and mental health problems that we're seeing in and around COVID can be connected to just all of this sort of disengagement from each other and community and so on, and just really spending a lot of time with our screens and our devices, and online shopping is a big part of that.
Well, we'd love to hear from listeners on this. What are your thoughts about consumption, about shopping, about what this is doing to the planet, to our health? How have your shopping habits changed over the last couple of decades? If you'd like to talk about your experience or friends and family, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What will it take for all of us to really just buy less stuff? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Anastasia, can you tell us more about the Carbon Containment Lab at Yale University? And what are you all really looking at when it comes to these issues? I mean, to visualize Amazon, FedEx, and UPS delivering so many packages, to visualize the plastic, the cardboard, the bubble wrap, but then to also think about the carbon emissions that it takes to deliver all this stuff.
Yeah, at the Yale Carbon Containment Lab, we're actually looking at pretty innovative solutions for carbon removal and quite large scale, approaches with natural climate solutions and engineered approaches to actually remove carbon from the atmosphere. However, the way I got into looking at that is to really think about the scale of the climate problem and where in a typical supply chain are the biggest emissions. So That's actually usually in the supply chain of a product or of a company or of an organization, much further up the chain than we're used to thinking about. So it's these are emissions that can be quite hard for an individual or an organization or a company to actually control directly because it's out of their hands. So it's further down the chain or up the chain, if you like. And so we're looking at the lab at all sorts of approaches of dealing with emissions per se, but I think it's a challenging organizational problem of who actually is going to deal with those sorts of emissions, who's responsible for them, how do you actually pay for those? Can we rely on carbon offset credits to mitigate some of this? And so that's the sort of thing we work on and we like thinking about. But you're right that it is quite hard to visualize. Just the scale is enormous.
What does the research say about online shopping versus going to a brick and mortar store in terms of emissions and the effect that it has on the planet?
Actually, for a lot of products and services, really the emissions tied to them are in the product itself and the packaging and the shipping and so on. It's a portion, but it's not the whole story. So it's not, I don't have numbers handy with me, and I'm sure some of your listeners would be able to weigh in on this with some actual data. I'd love it if anyone's listening and they had some. But I think, you know, you think about it, you drive to the store or the truck drives to you one way or another. There's some driving going on. I think the thing that's different is that when you're online shopping, you just have a much bigger array of products that you can buy. And it's a very enabling environment, if you like. So I think that we've all seen shopping increase and we're all buying more. And part of that is pandemic sort of spending and part of it is entertainment, perhaps, I don't know. But yeah. I think from a carbon emissions point of view, just the greater the volume of purchasing and buying that we're all doing means that it's in those products and here we are with these products in our homes. Are we really using them? I hope so. But at some point they'll turn into waste and trash and, you know, that's a big waste of resources.
JB, what are your thoughts on this? How do you talk to people about this aspect of this crisis, the effect that all of this buying has on the planet? What really sticks with people?
What I find sticks with people is actually not so much the impacts of the products on the environment, but the impacts of the products on themselves. I mean, I think a lot of people, as Anastasia noted, are frustrated, deeply frustrated by the fact that they are buying products that don't last as long as they used to. And I agree with her that that said, we often do buy products and dispose of them even before their lifespans are, their useful lifespans have actually wound up. But it's still across generations, across political ideologies, frustration with the shift towards disposability is really palpable in my conversations.
He just reminded me of what Apple does. I'm reading from a piece in November 2020 from NPR. Apple agreed to pay $113 million to settle consumer fraud lawsuits brought by more than 30 states over allegations that it secretly slowed down old iPhones, a controversy that became known as Batterygate. Apple first denied that it purposely slowed down iPhone batteries, then said it did so to preserve battery life and widespread reports of iPhones unexpectedly turning off. I mean, those of us who have bought iPhones, which are so ridiculously expensive, have this experience where after a couple years, your phone starts slowing down.
Right. And solutions are also just right there at our fingertips. In Europe, there's a telephone available, smartphone available, produced by a company called Fairphone, and it's a modular phone. I sat down with the Fairphone folks and they said, you know, what's a problem you've had with your phone? I said, oh, I've had problems with my plug-in jack. And they slid the screen off, pulled out the jack and popped another jack in, and it took them less than 1 minute. That's the kind of thing that they've designed this phone for. It's unfortunately not available in North America, but clearly there are solutions like that that are available to us. Instead, what we're getting from the corporations that produce the products are products that are just really committed to this model by which we buy something and then we buy it again and again and again throughout our lifetimes.
So I just found Fairphone online. Nothing like this, to your knowledge, exists in the United States?
As far as I know, no.
Huh. So in the case of Apple, what does it take? I mean, could the government step in here and say it's illegal to do something like this?
There has been a widespread discussion about this idea of a right to repair. And through that, there'd be some kind of, President Biden mentioned it, I think, earlier this year. And through that, there would be some kind of mandate placed upon at least some companies that produce some products, that those products be designed in such a way that they can be easily repaired. And these are the kinds of things that are concrete steps that could be taken that might actually start to move us towards a lower consuming society as a whole, so that it isn't just thrust upon us as individuals to try to swim against the current and become people who consume less than everybody around them, or to try to navigate the environmental impacts and social impacts of every single thing we buy.
Hmm. Well, we'll definitely talk more about solutions after a break. But before we do that, let's hear from one caller. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Well, first of all, I try to buy as rarely online as I possibly can, which means virtually never. But there are a lot of companies now that are just selling online. So if you want a product or you need something, that's the only place you can get it. Secondly, I will say this. I've paid for some expensive appliances, just to give you an example of what you were talking about, within the last 5 years, which I really couldn't afford, couldn't buy the extended warranties. And within a year, these appliances were starting to fail. And I have a washing machine that I bought 30 years ago, a Whirlpool, that hasn't had a repair made to it. It's still functioning today. So you can't, and plus, you can't find a place to repair any of these things. That's impossible. Last, I just want to say about the environmental impacts. If I shop at a store where I live in Palo Alto, one of the Whole Foods stores, you're going to see products coming in from all over the world. I mean, they might sell olives from Greece or whatever, Italy, and you're going to have a hard time finding USA. Olives grown in the United States. So the weird thing about this is that people are really going to have to rethink this whole notion of importing and exporting goods, because that is having a huge impact environmentally, because it's got to be shipped everywhere. And I think people are going to have to really think about that whole notion of countries importing and exporting goods.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. We've done some shows about the fact that we have access to, for example, fruits that don't grow in the U.S. We're bringing in things like blueberries from South America, for example. Thank you for the call. We're going to take a quick break and we'll ask our guests to respond when we come back. Anastasia O'Rourke is Managing Director at the Carbon Containment Lab at Yale University. JB McKinnon is an award-winning journalist and author of The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. Today, we are talking about what it will take to get all of us to buy less stuff. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about consumption and what it will take for us to buy less stuff. People in the United States are shopping more than ever. During the pandemic, people have been buying more and more online. We're talking about this with Anastasia O'Rourke, Managing Director at the Carbon Containment Lab at Yale University. JB McKinnon is Adjunct Professor of Journalism at the University of British Columbia, where he teaches feature writing. He's the author of The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. And if you have any stories to share about consumption or how your habits have changed. If you have any tips for people who would like to shop less and maybe just buy what they need or buy reused things, finding free things online, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. How should we bring the idea or the topic of consumption into all of these stories about the backed up supply chain? And just generally, how should we really talk about this issue? Anastasia, what comments would you add to Greg's about, first off, he talked about buying appliances and the fact that they kind of start to break after about a year, or they don't work as well after a year. And then he also wanted to talk about importing and exporting goods and really rethinking that.
I think for the appliances that break, this is, you know, if you look at what's actually breaking, sometimes it's just a small component. And that's why it's so frustrating that you can't actually get a fix very easily, because it's often like a chip or, you know, just a minor thing that could, you have this whole huge fridge that then needs to be replaced. So part of the problem there is the design, that you know, design for obsolescence, if you like, and just the durability and the quality considerations. But also there's not, you know, we don't really have a great service repair kind of economy anymore. And so even if you wanted to get it repaired, I think you mentioned, you know, it's hard to find the people to do that. I think that approach has been a little bit lost because we have such cheap goods and services. It's faster and cheaper just to replace it. And unfortunately, from an environmental point of view, it's a huge impact, especially if you add it up across all of the households, you know, in the US and across the world, it's having a big impact. So I guess, the things that we could do about it as citizens could be to press the companies, press the regulators, press the big retailers like, you know, like the Amazons and the Whole Foods and others to really start to insist on higher quality all the way through the products and the ability to repair them as well.
JB, do you have anything to add on Greg's comment about importing and exporting goods?
I mean, honestly, I think that's probably a better question for Anastasia, but certainly, I think one of the results of the economy through which we're importing so many goods has been this idea that companies have been able to go overseas and they've been able to exert pressure, downward pressure, usually on wages, often downward pressure on environmental regulations in countries overseas as they build their industries there. And, you know, a result of that has been a lack of, or a loss of livability in those countries, but also the capacity of these companies to produce so many cheap goods and to send them to us, where they can be used to really encourage this model of making profits as a company through a high turnover of low quality goods.
Well, thanks again for the comments, Greg. Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from, Linda in San Francisco. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, you sound fine.
Great. Yeah, thank you for this discussion. It's a really important one. And my background is in fashion, and I teach fashion and sustainability at California College of the Arts and have written books on the subject. And what I wanted to bring to the conversation was to really emphasize conspicuous production in addition to this conspicuous consumption that we're talking about, which I feel really scapegoats the consumer, because companies are producing way more than anybody can buy, especially in fashion, and they have huge advertising budgets persuading consumers to buy. And for example, Patagonia, in their B Corporation report of 2019, said, "We're making progress to being a carbon neutral company, but despite the progress, our footprint is increasing due to our growth in sales. And it's that dependency of business. You know, businesses are designed for obsolescence, not just the product. And there was another point that I wanted to make again in fashion, that physical durability actually, in this model, this where we're compelled to grow and dispose of products, you know, in my case, garments, physical durability isn't enough when those garments end up in landfill or overseas. They need to be connected to use. So physical durability can be a liability when we're in this model of constant disposal. And it needs to be, you know, garments need to be designed for actual use and not overbuilt for use, like, for example, the outdoor industry does with their garments that are then not used for climbing mountains, but used for, you know, sipping coffee in cafes and so on.
Well, I'm glad. Thank you so much for the call, Linda. I'm glad you brought up fashion. JB, you have a chapter in your book about fashion, and you point out that, quote, sustainable fashion is trending, but over the past 20 years, the number of garments purchased per person increased by 60%, while the lifespan of those clothes was cut nearly in half. So tell us more about what you found there.
Well, again, it's really this drift towards this high turnover model. And so as clothes became cheaper and less durable, we bought more of them. So it's not even necessarily a case, as we might imagine when we hear a stat like 60% more, you know, more clothing per person being purchased. It's not even necessarily a case of consumer greed or acquisitiveness, so much as the fact that this is the world we live in now. If you go to buy things, most of them aren't going to last very long, and they're very inexpensive. So it's quite easy to make the choice to dispose of things that no longer look new and buy another set of clothes. So in fact, as I was working on this book, this idea was emerging that it's not just a question of novelty, like new styles and new looks, but newness itself. The fact that as clothes have become so inexpensive, there has been this trend towards a desire to always look like you are wearing brand new things. And you see this expressed really clearly through social media, where people on platforms like TikTok and Instagram do not want to be seen in the same outfit twice.
You, in your book, you interviewed Abdullah Al-Maher, the CEO of a knitwear firm in Bangladesh that produces fast fashion for those companies like H&M and Zara. Tell us a little bit about the conversation that you had with Abdullah Al-Maher. He said that transitioning to a lower consuming society would be very painful for the country. They've got about 6,000 clothing factories, and if people started buying less, that could be cut in half.
Yeah, this is one of the most surprising conversations I had while working on this book. And I reached out to Abdullah Al-Maher because I thought that he would be the type of person who would say to me, no, we have to keep consuming the way we are in the West because the economies of these other countries depend on it. And instead, he responded with an answer that was very surprising to me. So he said, no, I think that it would actually be better for the fashion industry to shift towards a model of producing a slower fashion cycle, a lower rate of turnover, producing fewer but better things, and that it would be worth it even if that came at if that had to come with a costly transition. I mean, obviously, he would hope that that any kind of transition like that would be taken in a stepwise manner that took care for the most vulnerable people in that process. But he thought getting to a place where people were being paid living wages, where the environmental consequences for his country were not so great, would be the most valuable place we could end up. And maybe the most surprising thing that he said to me was that the price we're paying for the clothing that his company produces in countries like the United States and, you know, the rest of the wealthy world are are stripping the dignity from the work that his company and his workers are doing, and that they're aware of this, that they know that they are, you know, working almost literally night and day to produce hundreds of thousands of garments that are going out into the world and being purchased for a few dollars and being disposed of after a few wears.
Hmm. You know, there have been so many reports about women in mostly women in Bangladesh who work in these factories. And The Guardian had a piece in 2019, the average worker in Bangladesh works about 6 days a week and makes, let's see, $90. I was just converting it. $90 a month. $90 a month for working in these factories. And during COVID, so many of the orders were canceled. And so people were making no money working for these multinational brands. Anastasia, do you have anything to add about fast fashion? This is getting so much more media attention these days. Do you know, or do we have any idea if this is making any impact?
I sure hope so. I think with brands that are really trying to improve the quality on the environmental side and the lifespan of their products are doing really well, brands like Patagonia, but also many others. I think they're looking pretty comprehensively at not only the sort of climate impacts of their materials and production systems, but the labor conditions, you know, deep in the supply chain of where things are made and who are making them and how they're made, as well as actually, you know, the toxic chemicals that are people don't really quite realize how many chemicals go into some of these fabrics, technical or non-technical, that we're all enjoying from a fashion point of view. So I do think that there is a shift, but it's slow and it's certainly not sector-wide. So you just need to go down to an outlet mall or, you know, any kind of large sort of retail outlet to see just the huge array of fabrics and materials and that sense of just volumes of material that are in these stores. To get a quick glimpse at it. Once you start seeing that, once you start learning about the impacts associated with all of this, it can be, you know, quite overwhelming. But I do think that there are some things that you can do as a consumer or as a buyer and start to be more thoughtful about what you're buying, how much you're buying, and really go for those sorts of brands that are taking this seriously and making, you know, making efforts towards improving their impacts.
Mm. Well, thanks again for the call, Linda, and we'll definitely do more shows about this in the new year. Let's go next to Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Thanks for holding.
Hi, Rose. Thanks so much for this show. I just wanted to put out the information. Every year there's a group that does this event called Buy Nothing Day, and they schedule that day on the Friday after Thanksgiving, which I believe it's called Black Friday. I've never participated. But anyhow, firstly, I have a problem with that name, Black Friday, something I just don't like about it. But anyhow, that's the day that's like a consumption holy day. And anyhow, this group runs this event called Buy Nothing Day, where you just basically don't buy anything on that day. And I think it's an inspirational message, and I just wanted to share that.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for that. We have a link to Buy Nothing on our resources at yourcallradio.org. Thank you so much for that. And if you have any resources you want to share, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org, or you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. Today, we're joined by Anastasia O'Rourke, Managing Director at the Carbon Containment Lab at Yale University. J.B. McKinnon is Adjunct Professor of Journalism at the University of British Columbia and author of The Day the World Stops Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. What a great title. And that is what we're talking about on today's Your Call. Let's go next to George in San Leandro. Hi, George.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've personally kind of adopted a motto that I understand was popular during the Great Depression. It goes, something like this. Use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. And I adopted that, interestingly, after having attended my first intensive week-long, 10-day-long meditation retreat, because the practice of meditation I found has allowed me to basically take back my mind and to understand better how desire, which is a word one of your guests used a minute ago, operates in the mind, and how essentially, even though so many of us are aware of how our behavior is destroying the planet, we are still continuing that behavior. And the way, one way forward is to actually understand how the corporations actually understand our minds better than we do. And for example, the aspect of desire in our minds, which is when one desire is fulfilled, one other desire automatically arises again. One finds this to be a truth when one spends time basically doing nothing except exploring the operation of one's mind.
Well, thank you for the call. You actually just reminded me, we're planning to do a show in the new year about an incredible program in the Bay Area that brings meditation to schools. It teaches children in grade school about meditation and breathing, especially kids that are dealing with, you know, whether it's gun violence or just other types of violence. And so thank you for the call. And we're definitely going to do that show in the new year. Let's go next to Dale in San Francisco. Hi, Dale. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for your show. It's great.
Thank you.
I have a story about buying a used phone, an iPhone, and trying to get my provider to switch my number to the phone. I went into their store, met with a rep. He looked at the phone. He says, I don't think I can activate this phone, but I'll try. And then he sent me to a phone where I talked to a rep overseas who didn't know anything. And I got bounced around for a day. And it finally came that I went back to the seller who repairs and sells used Apple equipment in defiance of Apple. The seller hooked me up to another provider, and then it was another hell getting the original provider to let go of my number. It was traumatic.
Wow.
Anyhow, I have my new provider. I have my iPhone 5. I've had it repaired twice, and I'm happy.
Wow. Amazing story, Dale. I'm glad that you have a happy ending to share. Thank you so much for that call. We don't have that much time left in the show, but Dale, we definitely want to talk more about this in the new year to share these kinds of stories. A few other examples. We've got a lot of emails. Robert, I borrowed a range of gardening tools from the Oakland Tool Lending Library, all well-maintained. Stefan says, there's efforts by neighbors to share items like kitchen gadgets, home improvement tools, so people don't have to buy these things and they may be used only a few times. Howard, after rent, phone, and utilities, I live on Social Security. I'm left with about $200 a month. I think that DIY could be a big piece of the answer. I love figuring out ways to repurpose things I no longer need and make rather than buying things that answer whatever needs come up. I buy almost nothing but food, except I admit books. Thank you for that. A shout out to Narain's Outdoor Sewing and Repairs in Berkeley. Over the years, I've had zippers replaced and other repairs for a jacket, tent, sailing gear, and more. And then Alicia writes, I recently discovered Fern's Garden in Berkeley. Everything is fair trade, and it's a charming place to find gifts for mostly under $20. So there's lots of examples out there. Thank you so much for all of those examples. What are your thoughts, JB, about the sort of DIY trends coming back, people sharing things, people lending things?
I mean, I think those are great trends in the sense that they are expressing a broadening desire in society to shift away from this very high throttle consumer culture and maybe move towards an economy that's built more around quality and less around quantity. But there's challenges within it as well. I mean, certainly, I think it was Dale talking about his phone. I mean, in some cases, you're up against systems that really work against the desire to hang on to a product. Or you look at the fact that there is very little repair and maintenance sector in the economy today. So you need higher scale involvement than just the individual to try to make something like that emerge. Even the idea of sharing. I mean, I interviewed a woman who at the time was the director of the oldest tool lending library in the United States. And she said that it had become increasingly difficult to share goods because they are no longer designed to last through heavy usage. So she gave the example of snow shovels. You know, they sell snow shovels made out of plastic now. You can't sharpen a plastic snow shovel in the way that you can an old metal snow shovel. So this question of durability, really, you know, the rubber hits the road yet again when it comes to even our desire to share goods.
Hmm. Well, and we're almost out of time. I also just wanted to mention, and this is one thing we didn't get to really discuss today, but we'll definitely talk about this on a future show, that a lot of these warehouses for Amazon, for example, are in Black and brown neighborhoods, which creates a lot more air pollution in those areas. And so that's definitely also something to consider when you think about where you're shopping. Anastasia, final thoughts from you as we enter this holiday season, and this issue deserves so much more attention. About 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think about what you're buying, who you're buying from. Think about the love and generosity behind any gift and what you really want to bequeath to someone that you love, that you care about. Just think about, you know, supporting local businesses, for example, or service industry that's been hit really hard by the pandemic. Think about plants. think about buying nothing or buying, spending time with people. You know, get creative with it and keep learning, keep sharing your knowledge as well.
Well, that's a great way to end. Anastasia O'Rourke is Managing Director at the Carbon Containment Lab at Yale University. JB McKinnon is author of The Day the World Stopped Shopping, How Ending Consumerism Saves the Environment and Ourselves. Anastasia and JB, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.